Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome to the Jazz on the Two podcast series. Today we have a guest I'm very excited to speak with. If you lived in New York City in the late 70s and early 80s, you were lucky enough to be able to go to a place called Soundscape. And it may sound like hyperbole, but I believe it. I would put Soundscape in the same category as Birdland and the old Palladium. It was a place where really profoundly new things came to New York and the U.S. Through a venue. And Soundscape was run by someone named Verna Gillis, who we're going to be talking with in a second. And I believe it was the first venue dedicated to the concept of multicultural music, music from all over the place, including lots of great jazz. It was an amazing place. I think about it frequently. We're going to have an interview about that at some point, I hope. But today we're going to talk about Cuba. Verna is a PhD in ethnomusicology, and we're going to talk about somehow she managed to go all over the world recording music everywhere, and one of the places she went was Cuba. Some of her recordings, her field recordings, were collected and put into a CD by Smithsonian Folkways Archival called Music of Cuba. And the reason I've asked her to talk with us today is I think it's the best place to get started, the CD, to get a sense of the scope of Cuban music. You know, when you say Cuban music, that's kind of like saying ice cream. Well, what flavor are you talking about? There's thousands of them practically. And it's the same thing with Cuban music. This is a very broad, deep, and rich tradition. And, you know, you have to buy, 10 or 20 CDs to get a taste of it. But this one CD, I think, is just a great place to start. So, Verna, with that introduction, welcome. And thanks so much for being on the call.
Thank you, Ken. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, so, Verna, among the many things that you've done, you got a PhD in anthropology, and somehow you were on the road recording all over the world. Can you just tell us a little about how that came to be and, because that sounds like fun.
Yeah, it was fun. And, I do have a degree in ethnomusicologist, but I've never really considered myself an ethnomusicologist. Mm-hmm. I think at best what I call myself is a generalist.
Okay.
And one place took me to the next place. The most in-depth work that I ever did was in the Dominican Republic. And I was married for 34 years to a magnificent man named Bradford Graves. And he, similar to my father, actually, when I was a child, was a music fan of the deepest level. And I still have a very impressive LP collection. And we had wonderful, wonderful records from Cuba. And as you've mentioned in your introduction, at least from my point of view, Cuban music is the richest of the entire Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
The breadth, the scope, the variety, from very complex to more simple forms.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow the confluence of the African and the Spanish and the indigenous populations just yielded this amazing musical culture. So the year was 1978. And I had started doing field work in 1975. The first place that I ever went was in Haiti.
Uh-huh.
And then in those days, in 1978, you weren't really able to travel to Cuba. So mm-hmm. I had to go as part of a group with the Center for Cuban Studies, run by a woman named Sandra Levinson, and mm-hmm. we had to actually leave from Mexico. And I was there for 3 weeks over the new year, and it was extraordinary, extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
It was also a very interesting time to be in Cuba because that was the year when the people who had left when Castro took power,
mm-hmm.
Essentially the middle class, who had been termed by him Los Cruzanos, the worms,
Mm.
suddenly they were in desperate economic straits, partly because of the embargo.
Mm-hmm.
So Castro started letting the Cubans who now lived in Florida come back
mm-hmm.
to see their families, and the reason was because they would bring dollars.
Right.
And they would
right.
bring dollars to them. So the people who had previously been called the worms suddenly became La Comunidad. And I tell you, the trip would have been interesting enough if I had never left my hotel lobby.
Wow.
I witnessed all these, I still get goosebumps when I think about them, all these extraordinary family reunions. And, you know, one of the things that I've learned is that, especially in Cuba and other places in the world that I've been where they used to refer to them as third world countries, but I prefer to say, you know, countries where time has not yet become money
mm-hmm.
in the same way that it has in the West.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not the same sense of urgency about earning it. And people are so generous with their time. And, of course, sharing their culture. And the fortunate thing for me my whole life has been to create situations where I am in the middle of the music.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because, you know, in those records, in the record that came out from Cuba or from other places where I did field work, the thing to remember is that I was there. I was
yeah,
in the
exactly.
midst.
That's
I was in the, that's right. I was in the midst of it. I was, my life was fortunate to bring me to those places.
Let me ask you a question, because you were there 3 weeks, but my goodness, just on this CD alone, which I'm sure is just the tip of the iceberg of what you recorded, you really got around and you really sampled a lot of different kinds of music. How did you organize that so well? I really think Music of Cuba, recorded by Vernon Gillis in Cuba in 1978-79, is a great place for anybody that's saying, okay, I want to understand Cuba and its music. So how did you, I mean, you touched on almost everything. You got some rumba, you got some palos, you got some Santeria, you got some conga, you got some son. I mean, you got street vendors calling, selling fish. I mean, you didn't miss a beat. How did you do
it? I'm a good organizer. I did a certain amount of work before I knew what I wanted to hear, and mm-hmm. and people are forthcoming. You know, all you need. Well, I can tell you what I used to do. When I used to arrive in countries where I knew no one, I would go to radio stations.
Ah.
And taxi drivers. Taxi
okay.
drivers are always your best resource because they come from communities where music is active.
Uh-huh.
So I will say that making those connections is the easiest.
Really?
And
okay.
also, people were warm, welcoming, open. I was from the United States. They all had interest in the United States, and the fact that I was there to record music was interesting to them as well. My roommate, let's see, how old was I in 78? This is big math. Let me figure it out. 6, 4, 5, 6. I guess I was 36
okay.
in 78. And my roommate was a woman who was at least twice my age by the name of Jane Wood.
Mm-hmm.
And she and her husband had started going to Cuba in the 50s. She was mm-hmm. a woman who was a political activist, had gone to Smith College, come from a wealthy family, and she and her husband would go every year to Cuba to work in the cigar factories, because the cigars were one of Cuba's main exports. I was very fortunate that we shared a room. And she actually helped me. She helped me carry, you know, in those days, recording music meant that I was carrying a reel-to-reel tape recorder,
yep.
boxes of tapes,
yep.
mic stands. I mean, when I think about it now, you know, from right now, I try to figure out where I can put my small digital recorder when I'm traveling somewhere. But I mean, in those days, it was a major schlep. And, you know, I was young and I loved the music and there I was. And as I said, people introduce you to people. It goes fast. All you mm. need is one good connection.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the recording that I did was in Havana.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And then the group that I was part of through the Center for Cuban Studies made a trip to Santiago.
Okay.
And that was another blissful recording experience in La Casa de la Trova, the old guys singing these beautiful boleros.
Mm.
So, you know, it was magical. The whole trip was magical.
One of the things that was eye-opening for me when I went to Cuba, I'd heard this music my whole life, but I never visualized it. And once I visualized it, it was life-changing, which is the rumba.
Oh, my God.
Right.
Well, let me, you know, the thing with Cuban music was I was there in 1978 and over the New Year into 79.
Mm-hmm.
In May of 1979, I opened my performance space, Soundscape, on West 52nd Street, which I'm delighted to know you were there. And when we meet, I'd love to know what you remember about it.
Mm-hmm.
I opened it, and then that's the next year you had the Mariels, the Marielitos, left Cuba and came to the United States. And Soundscape became the home for all those Cuban musicians.
Oh.
And in fact, Paquito de Rivera, the first who had, he was not part of the Marielitos, he had left Cuba and gone to Spain and from Spain to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the deep rumberos, Puntilla Rios, Daniel Ponce, they all ended up at Soundscape, and Soundscape became the home in exile for these Cuban musicians. And every Tuesday night I had the Latin night at Soundscape. Were you ever there for that?
I'm sorry to say no. I didn't get it.
Well,
I was more a jazz guy and
yeah.
Arab music and, you know. I'm catching up.
I'm trying to remember. God, I don't remember Eddie's. Oh, wow. Anyhow, they all ended up at Soundscape, and rumba became a staple. And
mm-hmm.
and at 2 in the morning when the regular Latin music night would be over, we'd lock the doors and all the rumberos would stay. And though, I mean, it was like having Cuba right on 52nd
wow.
Street, fresh off the boat. And, you know, also it was a lot of the Puerto Rican musicians who had kept Cuban music alive during those years
sure.
because of the embargo. And the most amazing thing to see was the Cuban sense of clave versus the Puerto Rican sense of clave.
Okay.
And they had what I call the clave wars. And you would have Daniel Ponce, you know, dictating what the clave was. I mean, it was exciting, thrilling, and, you know, a beautiful time. And I always felt somehow that trip to Cuba, I mean, I always wondered if I walked on streets and even passed any of the musicians who later played at Soundscape.
Mm. Yes, yeah, an amazing confluence of events. You come back from Cuba, you open Soundscape.
And then the Cubans arrive.
Amazing. Oh, I wish I had been hip to that. I was just, you know, I was young and I was sort of jazz-oriented, and so that's what I spent my money on. But I would hear the music in the air, you know, especially in that time. Everywhere, it seemed like everywhere you went.
Yes, indeed. Are you familiar with Daniel Ponce?
Oh, I know his work for sure, yeah.
Do you have New York now?
I don't.
I'm going to send you MP3 files to your email.
Okay.
You know, this was the... He was a street musician. I tell you, if I had it in me, I would try to make a movie about his life.
Mm.
You know, he was a street musician. He played for Carnival. He was a musician who actually went to jail at the age of 18 for 5 years. And he was socially difficult for the Cuban government. And he was one of the people who was told to leave. He was not. He did not want to leave. He was told that you have a few hours, you're leaving. You know, they got rid of a lot of what they considered their riffraff in those days.
Yes, yes, I remember.
And as a result, Daniel Ponce ended up at Soundscape. Andy and Jerry Gonzalez discovered him playing congas in Central Park. Brought him to Soundscape, and then I started working with him. And it was actually working with Daniel Ponce that I discovered what I can do working with talent.
Okay.
And Daniel Ponce had a life in the United States beyond his wildest dreams. You know, he did a solo once in Carnegie Hall.
Wow.
He arrived totally fucked up, drunk, 20 minutes before, and everyone was freaking out. But he did a solo. He did a solo at the Berlin Jazz Festival. And he played on Herbie Hancock's Rocket. He put the batad drum on. That was the first time the batad drum appeared in American pop music. And that was produced by Bill Laswell. He performed on a record with Laurie Anderson. He performed on a record with the Rolling Stones.
Wow.
You know, and this is this guy who was barely literate, who played carnival and rumba in Cuba, and he became a star here.
Wow. And when you say carnival, just so people know, we're not talking about a, you know, place with, you know, roller coasters. We're talking about kind of a parade-like event.
Yes.
Much more than a parade that takes place in Havana and Santiago de Cuba, I think.
Yes, all over in July, actually. It takes place in July. I mean, but they have, you know, the same kind of thing in Mardi Gras. They call it Mardi Gras in New Orleans. But, you know, where you have strong vestiges of Caribbean culture, you have carnival. That's part of it.
And the great thing about the Internet these days is you can go to YouTube and, you know, put in Carnival Santiago de Cuba, and you'll see all kinds of footage. Same thing with Roomba. You could spend a couple of days just watching all the Roomba clips out there, and many of them are quite good. And, you know, this issue of untrained, you know, unschooled musicians in Cuba, when people go, you'll quickly see that the whole culture is just infused with music, and there's endless opportunities to play and participate and learn, and
You know, I wouldn't call them unschooled. I certainly know what you mean. I would just say that they attended the University of the Streets, you know, which is extremely valuable. The kind of training that they got on the streets, nobody who goes to a conservatory gets.
Sure.
You know,
I mean, we could say Louis Armstrong was unschooled. We could say Charlie Parker was unschooled. I don't think he got a formal musical education.
Exactly.
So.
That's right. Unschooled and playing extremely complex music. You know, the tradition is different.
And let's talk about that for...
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Because this is, you know, we all have our biases, and we certainly grow up in a culture with biases. Let's talk about this—the utter depth of sophistication of Cuban rhythmic music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's different, but it's as complex as anything ever produced by Mahler or, you know, Berg or any of these. I mean, it is out there in terms of sophistication. Would you agree? Because, you know, in our culture, drums are kind of the thing in the back of the band, and they're not really very important.
Yes, no, it's complex rhythmically, and it's complex harmonically. You know,
right,
and very rich melodically.
Because they're producing, in addition to the rhythmic patterns, which are complex, they're also producing tones.
They're producing tones on the percussion as well as in the vocal music. You know, so you have everything going on, harmony, rhythm, and melody.
That's the beautiful thing about rumba is drums and voice, and you don't need anything else. It fills the universe. You know?
Yes,
I mean,
it does. Yes, it does.
I envy those late night sessions. Sounds good. That must have been incredible.
It was incredible. Those were the days when you put your sunglasses on at 6:30 in the morning so you can go out and go home. You know, and
I heard that you maybe recorded some stuff. Did you documented some things from those years?
Oh, I documented everything. You know, it's interesting, things about oneself that kind of accompany you your whole life. I've always had the archivist gene.
Uh-huh.
I've always archived. I mean, I don't know how that happens. If you're ever interested in putting things up, I've got hours and hours and hours of music that's never been released.
Wow, I think our subscribers would be really interested in that, because you know, we focused on the ethnomusical side or the music from other countries and the Cuba side, but Soundscape was also an amazing jazz venue. I'll tell you one of my highlights, and I miss this guy terribly, was the young Arthur Raines.
Oh, yes, yes. Do you have the CD, Ken?
I don't.
You know, send me an email with your address. I'll send you a whole bunch of the Soundscape, Live from Soundscape CDs.
Oh, great.
And I have one just with Arthur Raines.
That would be great. At the time you were running Soundscape, in the late 70s, I was in college. And,
where were you in college, Ken?
I went to Princeton.
And what did you study?
Anthropology, I forced an ethnomusicology subspecialty on them against their will, but I did it. So that's what I was studying. And I forget how I ran into Arthur. I probably met him through Beth Cummins at Indian Navigation. I know she was a huge fan.
Oh, my God. How is she? Do you know how she is or where she is?
You know, it's been years. I know, you know, Jerome passed away. I know they were
together. I know,
together.
My yeah. God.
He was a big friend. I loved him. And he taught me a lot about drumming, I'll tell you that.
Jerome Cooper?
Jerome Cooper, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he opened my ears to drumming.
that was Milford Graves for me.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. So many great musicians, such a rich period, that late 70s, early 80s time in New York was magic. I wish everybody could, well, thanks to your archiving, people can at least get a feel for it. So I went to a lot of jazz at Soundscape, and the idea that it's documented is just amazing. I mean, wow.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to
talk. Where do you live now?
Oh, you know, I live in Tivoli.
Oh, that's right. You told me that. You've got to come and visit us.
Oh, I will. I will. And I always, when people go, where the heck is Tivoli? I say, well, Sonny Rollins used to be my neighbor. He was just he was just 2 miles down up the road, you know, so it's not that obscure a place. We have so many great musicians living in our area, you know, Jack DeJohnette and...
oh yes,
he's here, and you know, and Sonny is here, and it's quite a jazz center. I'm not sure that we have listeners from all over the world, and they just probably don't think of the Mid Hudson Valley as being a jazz center. But if you look where a lot of the cats actually live,
mm-hmm.
They're here, and we get to see some amazing shows. For instance, I saw. Wow, this was a theater. I don't think it sat more than 50 people. It was a fundraiser, and Pat Metheny and Jack DeJohnette came out and did this fundraiser for this group. And what fun! You know, they had a bass player. I can't remember his name, and it was hilarious. And because at one point, Pat Metheny said, "All right, everybody, turn off your cell phones. I'm going to play the drums."
Uh-huh.
I mean, we get that kind of really fun stuff that you're not going to see in the big concert halls, you know, of the world. So Hudson Valley is a great musical center. Well, Verna, I want to thank you so much. For people that want to track Verna's work, and it's a lot more than Soundscape, and it is a lot of stuff she's involved in, and it's very interesting, is go to Verna Gillis. There's two L's in Gillis, yes?
Correct, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's VERNAGILLIS.com. I'm going to have a link right underneath the audio here on the page, so you can get it there too. But it's Verna Gillis, com. You can read all about her work and all the things that she's done and is continuing to do in various fields. It's very interesting stuff. I really do think Soundscape was one of the most important music venues in New York City's history, especially if you're talking about that slice of time in New York. I mean, it was a very, very important place. It was a center for all kinds of stuff, and now I'm learning it was a center for Cuban music. I wish I could go back in time. I could listen to it. Because, you know, when I grew up, I tell people, you know, I was an Irish Catholic kid, and you know, it was kind of like West Side Story where I grew up, you know, the Jets and the Sharks.
Oh, God, that's wonderful that you, you know, say that. Yes, indeed. In fact, I'll send you photographs if you'd like to put them up on your website. I mean, one of the things that I did there was I got Danielle and Pontilla together with Celia Cruz. And, you know, she would not go back to Cuba. She had very strong feelings about the government. And she hadn't done anything rumba-based. And I'll send you the photographs of the rehearsals at Soundscape.
Well, actually, you know, I found on the KCR archive a recording of a rehearsal with her. I don't know if you remember.
Right, that's right.
From Soundscape, so people can see it and hear it. I mean, what an epic.
You know, you could download that and put it on your website.
With your permission, thank you.
Absolutely.
We will do that.
Anything that I have, I mean, the goal is to have people hear it.
Okay. Thank you so much, and I'll make sure I clear everything we do, but that's a great offer, and I appreciate it. Well, Vernon, you were so kind.
Send me your address, and I'll send you CDs, and then let us know when you'd like to come visit.
Great. I will do it.
Certainly you're going to want to talk to Roswell, so.
Oh, yeah. That's a whole other story.
Yes,
but,
indeed. You really should talk to him.
Well, we'll catch up with all that, and in the meantime, I want to thank you for taking this time out this morning. I know morning is your creative time, and it was very nice.
It's my wake time. Anyhow, I look forward to meeting you, Ken. Send me your address.
I will. I'm going to do that right now.
Okay. Thank you so much. Speak to you soon.
You're welcome. Thank you, Verna.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, this is Ken McCarthy, and that was a informal, off-the-cuff conversation with Verna Gillis, formerly of Soundscape. Soundscape no longer exists, but it sounds like that archive is going to be open to us. So I'm going to look into what the cost is going to be to get that stuff online. There's a lot of it, guys. There's hundreds of hours of it. So we're going to probably do it piece by piece. And I really mean that when I say that Soundscape really has to be right up there with Birdland and the old Palladium and CBGBs as being an unbelievably important center for a new approach to music. You know, CBGBs was for the punks, and Birdland was for bop and for bebop, and Palladium was for the mambo. And the idea of bringing musicians from all over the world to showcase their work and to create collaborations, possibilities for collaborations, that was not going on. Now it's everywhere, right? But I'm here to tell you that was not something that was on the radar in the 70s. And Verna, with her fascinating background and her great love for music and her great organizational ability, made that happen. And I'm so sorry that as a 19 and 20-year-old, I wasn't smart enough to understand how great Cuban music was, because it sounds like I missed out on some amazing sessions. But it also sounds like some of those sessions were recorded, thank you, Verna, and preserved. And bit by bit, we're going to figure out how to get them on the site for you. So this is Ken McCarthy for Jazz on the Tube. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for all your support, by the way. I don't think I do that enough. You know, we have subscribers that actually send us money to help us do what we do. And it really helps, because we do have hard expenses, you know, the server and that email management program. You know, we got to pay by the month, and then this is just a lot of stuff to do what we do. And it helps. You know, people that send support are really helping. If the only support you can give is warm wishes and sharing the site with others, that's huge too. You know, if you can only give a dollar, we think that's amazing. I mean, we're grateful for any and all help. So anyway, thanks for tuning into this. This was a very interesting preliminary conversation. I think we're going to be doing a lot of work with Verna, and she's kind of a neighbor. She's one of the great New York music / jazz / world music people who migrated up here to the countryside when Manhattan got too expensive for us. All right. Well, hey, take care, everybody.